Hello and welcome to the 100 Year Real Estate Investor. My name is Kristen Kolka. I'm a 100 Year Real Estate Investor team member, and I'm here with our co-founder, Teresa Kuhn. Hi, Teresa. How are you?
I'm great, Kristen. Thank you so much. This is great.
Wonderful. So, Teresa, today we're going to be busting some myths. We have four common myths about cash value whole life insurance that we hear quite often. It's a lot of different questions and subject matter that often gets confused. And if you're doing research online, you're probably going to find a lot of different answers for these questions. So we wanted to hop on the 100 Year Real Estate Investor podcast today and bust some of these myths for our listeners.
Absolutely. And there is a lot of misinformation out there. And, you know, what we do can be so nuanced and people can grasp onto a concept and think that concept applies across the board. And nothing could be further from the truth. So big picture, yeah, might be true. But when you get to the details or you get to specific design or a specific strategy or solution, it may not apply. So that's why we're here today, to bust those myths that are out there. And just as an aside, I had a really interesting call today with an investment advisor who works for one of the big houses, like one of the biggest houses out there. And he was really interested in what we do and had read information and was interested in actually engaging with us to start a policy. I was kind of shocked. We've had a couple of those over the years, but so more and more people are, I think, understanding what we do has so much value.
All right. Awesome. And so, Teresa, the first myth that I want you to bust is one that I hear all the time. And I think it's because a lot of the opponents of whole life insurance like to use this as a reason to not buy a policy. So when a policy insured dies, does the insurance company keep the cash value and only pay out the death benefit?
Well, that's a great question. In our design, from day one, when a client starts paying into the policy, they start paying premiums into the policy, their death benefit goes up or can go up with every premium payment. I say can go up because it depends how much money they're putting into the policy. From day one all the way through the life of the policy, you're going to see that death benefit go up every single year. So if you add up how much money premiums out of pocket were paid into the policy, the death benefit day one, and anytime into the future, you're going to see there is more death benefit than cash paid into the policy. So our designs keep up with inflation because, you know, Kristen, 10 years ago, maybe not even 10 years ago, 20 years ago, $1 million meant something. $1 million policy was like, oh, that's substantial. You know what? $1 million today doesn't mean a whole lot.
Right.
So when you've got these policies and with our designs, you know, if you start out with $1 million, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, that death benefit could be 2 million, could be 3 million. And that cash, all the dollars that have gone into the premium that get allocated to the cash value, that continues to grow as well. Is there anything to that that you would add?
I would say that I think a lot of the kind of opponents of whole life insurance that are making the claim that the insurance company keeps the cash value are referring to whole life insurance policies where the death benefit does stay level. So, you know, like you said, you're not seeing any growth year over year as you pay into the policy. Like you explained, our policies are different. The death benefit goes up every year. And so when you look at an illustration and you see that there's the two columns, the cash value and death benefit column, it's not that you're losing out on the cash value when the death benefit's paid. The death benefit's already including all of the growth of the policy and the premiums that you've paid in.
Yes. And I like to refer to the cash value as the living benefit. That's the money that you can tap into while you're alive. And that death benefit is there for your family when you die. Now, there is one other thing that we love about that death benefit is that most of our policies in most states, you can tap into that death benefit when you're alive if you have any major medical issues. Or you need critical care, or you need long-term care. That is a very specific term, depending on the state. Some states allow us to use that, some states do not. And also, if you have less than 12 months to live. So not only is that death benefit growing every single year as you pay premiums into the policy, but the amount of money that you have access to, if you need it from a living benefit perspective, can also grow.
That's a great point, Teresa. All right. So the next question that we get asked quite often is, what happens if someone can't afford their premiums or they have to stop paying premiums? Will they lose their policy?
Well, Kristen, that depends. In the early years of the policy is when the policy is most fragile, so to speak, right? Is most vulnerable of that policy lapsing. And if someone, let's say the first year pays into the policy, loses their job, no longer has cash flow, doesn't have any other dollars from which to position cash into the policy, there's probably not enough cash in that policy to keep that policy in force for a period of time, for a long period of time. So it's the early years of the policy where the policy is most vulnerable. In the later years of the policy, and it depends on design, right, what that exact number is. But for many of us, of our designs, year seven minimum, the policy can support itself. We've got designs where, depending on the circumstances, that can happen as early as 4 years or 5 years. But that is very specific design for very specific objectives that our clients have. Not every design can support itself after 4 years.
Right. So, you know, basically, as long as there is some cash value that's built up inside the policy, you can potentially not pay premiums for a period of time. It just depends on how much cash value is built up.
You got it. That's exactly right.
Got it. And I would say too, you know, Teresa, we work so closely with our clients that if we have a client that's having an issue, a budgetary issue, and maybe they can't afford their premiums, you know, we always tell them, get with us. There's options that you have. There's a minimum premium that you can pay. You know, maybe that's more affordable. Or like we've just talked about, if there's cash value, there's some options there in terms of having the policy support itself for a while.
And that's where a good design comes in. We design our policies with minimums and maximums, and maybe a client can't put in what they're typically used to putting in. Well, we can adjust. There is flexibility in our design to adjust the amount of premiums that go into the policy. So we always run numbers from a minimum perspective. And I tell clients, look, this is your minimum, but I don't want you to think that's what you're, you know, what the minimum, that's what you're going to put into the policy. If we're designing a policy with a minimum and the client is thinking that's all they're going to pay, I tell them, nope, I'm going to take back the keys of your Maserati and not give you that design. Because what's the point of driving a Maserati to the grocery store, right? A Maserati is built and designed to be driven to, you know, good capacity, maybe not maximum capacity all the time. So we design the policy based on the budget, but the minimum's there as, hey, I'm struggling, I've got a cash flow issue, as, you know, something catastrophic has happened, to help the client navigate through those times.
Absolutely. That's great. All right, Teresa. So myth number three, and actually this is a two-part question. So number one, what we hear a lot is that you only need to buy life insurance on the breadwinner of the family. So, you know, if there is a husband or a wife that stays at home with the kids, doesn't make as much, they don't need insurance because they'll be, you know, the breadwinner will be fine if something happens to them. And then the second part of that question is you should never buy insurance on your children.
Those are both loaded. Those are both super loaded questions. So, let's take the first one. You only need insurance on the breadwinner. Well, you know what? I don't know. We've been doing this long enough that we see that one of my favorite sayings is, life is what happens when we're busy making plans. So just because someone's the breadwinner today doesn't mean they're going to be the breadwinner forever. And I am You know, another one of my favorite sayings is the quality of your life is in direct proportion to the quality of options that you have, right? So maybe your spouse, and to be politically correct, it could be the husband or the wife, right? Stays at home with the kids and you think, oh, they're not bringing any income in. We don't need insurance on them, but they provide a very valuable service of taking care of the home, taking care of the kids. What if something happened to them and you need to replace them, right? From the perspective of hiring a nanny or schools or whatever, there is an economic loss to that family. And it can be a very tremendous loss. So I'm always of the opinion, hey, we insure husband and wife. We insure the breadwinner and the non-breadwinner, or the one that's making more money and the one that's not making as much money, because they bring an economic value to the relationship that if something happens to them, there's a tremendous loss.
Right. That's so true. And, you know, it might not be the same size policy, you know, someone that's bringing in more income, there's probably justification there for a higher death benefit on that person. But you're right that that person that's staying at home, that's taking care of the kids, that's taking care of the home, they're fulfilling a lot of roles that may have to be hired out if they're not there any longer. So what about the kids? Would you recommend insurance policies on children?
Absolutely, Kristen. And, you know, I was a person, even in my business, that often thought, I can't insure my child. If something happens to my child, I don't want to have an economic benefit from that. Like, I really could not make that connection. And then I had, I was introduced, referred to someone who lost their child when they were, the child was an adult in a motorcycle accident. And that child did have a life insurance policy. And the parents decided to take the money in that life insurance, at the time it was $100,000, and set up a charity to take care of whatever it was that they had a heart for. And at that time, my perspective completely shifted. I also was intimately impacted by the suffering of losing a child from friends and other people that I knew, and the amount of time and energy and money that they spent on therapy and healing, and the economic loss from the perspective of the family, the parents not being able to work. There was such a great economic loss. I have chills just thinking about it. And it totally shifted and changed my perspective on insuring children. Now, I'm not even talking about what we do with our policies. I'm just talking about the economic loss that happens when you lose a child in terms of the cost. And what if a family doesn't have money for burying that child or to pay for therapy or many number of things that can happen? So that was one thing that completely shifted my thinking around insuring a child from the perspective of getting life insurance on a child. I'll pause there because there's some other things that we can talk about that are also very important when it comes to children's policies.
Yeah, I think that there's this polarity around life insurance proceeds where, you know, it can be seen as a good thing and a bad thing. A good thing in that, you know, like you said, it's an economic benefit. And do we want to feel like we're economically benefiting from the death of a child? It's a morbid thing to think about, right? So there's this bad side of that polarity there, right? Whereas if we think about an inheritance from an older relative, it can be a good thing, right? You know, it's someone who's lived their life and they're leaving something behind, they're leaving a legacy behind. But if you take out that good or bad, that polarity, it's really about that money that you're receiving being a tool to allow yourself to heal from a loss, right? And whether that's a child or a parent or a spouse, it's not just about replacing income. It's also about taking the time off of work to mourn that loss, you know, going to therapy, maybe, you know, like you said, starting a charity or a scholarship fund for other children to benefit. So there's a lot of different ways that that death benefit can be used. It's not just, oh, I'm benefiting from this loss. It's okay, I can do good for myself in the world because now I have this tool to do it.
Well said. Absolutely. There's also, from an economic perspective, there are many parents that are co-signing on children's student loans.
Yes.
And those loans still have to be paid back. So just because the child passed away does not mean that that loan is no longer, it has been void or has been paid off. That's a great economic burden on a family. And think about the triggers that occur every time they're making that payment for a child that has passed on.
Right.
It's a big deal. Now, on to happier thoughts. Starting policies on children from the perspective and the design and the strategy of giving children the opportunity to build cash value inside of a policy long-term and all the things that they can do with that cash inside those policies, that is a tremendous gift. We have many clients, they've been gifted a life insurance policy, a permanent policy from their parents or their grandparents or their great-grandparents, and they still speak about that like grandparent that gave them that policy, and to them that policy is precious. And the thought of that grandparent, right, and that gift lives on through that policy. That is one of the coolest things. And those aren't even policies that we would design today, right? But it's a gift. They cherish it. It's like their last man standing. It's, they never want to touch that because that has so much legacy from the perspective of that family connection. And then, of course, all the things that we can do that a child can do with these policies. I think this community understands very well what I've done with my son and his policies. And now he's paying his policies, thankfully, on his own. And the amount of cash that he's got in there, the loans that he's taken out, what he's been able to do with that money, it has been a tremendous gift.
And Teresa, just for those who aren't familiar with your son's story, just real quick touch on what you were able to do for him with his policies. And what he's been able to build for himself with his policies.
Yeah, one of my greatest joys of my life. So when I started his first policy when he was 11, his second policy when he was 14, and he's now 26 years old. And he was an only child, and he really didn't need too much. Like, he really didn't spend a lot of money for an only child. That was awesome, right? And he worked. He had a pet sitting business. And then in high school, he chose not to play sports. And we said, you're not playing sports, you've got to work. And so all of his paychecks went into his policies, along with money that we contributed. His Christmas presents, his birthday presents. We just wrote checks to the policy, whatever money he had that he wasn't spending, and he really didn't spend any money. They all went into his policy. Built up the policy. Then as a alternative to college, and that's a whole nother story, we started a family business for him to learn business in lieu of college. And we took a lot of the money that was in the policy to start the business. And that business was very, very capital intensive. It was very equipment intensive. And even though we had money set aside for college, we went ahead and used some of the money that was in that policy. And today he's paying that back. And his policy just rocks. It's just tremendous what that policy is able to give him.
That's such a cool story. I love that story. So, you know, outside of, you know, the life insurance component, the death benefit, this is just, it can be a great financial tool to gift to your children to teach them early on how to save and also how to finance big expenses without having to go through a bank or a credit card company.
That's it. That's an amazing gift right there, right? Just that alone.
Absolutely. All right, Teresa, our last myth that we're going to bust today, although this certainly is not the last myth out there about whole life insurance, but that would be a very long show. The last myth we're going to bust today is that insurance agents make really big commissions on whole life insurance sales. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, you can. You know, agents can make big commissions on life insurance sales. The way we design our policies are very friendly to the consumer. It is about minimizing death benefit, maximizing cash value, and the more cash, early cash, the client has within reason, because there's a reason to design the policy with a certain ratio, then the less money the agent makes. And so at 100-year real estate investor, we design these policies to maximize the cash value for the client and to minimize the death benefit. And do we get paid? Absolutely. If we don't get paid, we wouldn't be here, right? So we do get paid, and we get paid from the insurance company directly. So the numbers that, the dollars that are in the policy, those all belong to the client. Now, if we want to talk about commissions and we want to talk about fees, if you look at, in comparison, the amount of fees that real estate, Wall Street, other advisors and professionals in the financial services industry makes, we're actually close to the bottom of the totem pole in terms of what we make compared to the other professionals that make money off of transactions. It's just Wall Street has an amazing way of demonizing what we do. And there are reasons for that. Hey, they're protecting their turf. Their business model is assets under management. They're making money off of your money every single year. And as you grow your account, they're making money. If you've got a bad year, they're making money. So we've done these studies. We've done the spreadsheets showing, you know, dollar for dollar. And we've done the comparisons over time and just, you know, in conversation and just for us, right, to understand what's going on with fees and commissions in the financial services industry. And it is absolutely a win-win for the client, for the insurance company, and for the professionals. It has to be, otherwise you wouldn't have professionals, people who are good, who understand what they're doing in this business, because there'd be no money for us.
Right. Absolutely. So, you know, one, we got a pair of bills, but two, we design the policies so that they are, you know, in terms of the money that you're putting into the policy and what's commissionable and what's not, the bulk of the premium that you're paying is going towards a component that's not really commissionable. If it is, just a small percentage of it. So compared to a traditional whole life insurance policy, the commissions are actually lower. But that being said, if you compare what we make to an investment advisor, for example, who's charging 1%, 1.5% every single year on an account that's hopefully growing, right? That's what you expect it to happen. Those fees are getting more and more and more as that account grows. With life insurance, the commission's really paid up front on the first year's premium. And after that, any kind of residual commission's very small. And it's not paid out forever and ever and ever. So I think that's great, Teresa. Anything else that you would add? Any farewell thoughts?
You know, I always go back to philosophy, and I would have you consider, and what's your philosophy around money? What are your rules around money? What's your vision for your money? What's your vision for your wealth? It all goes back to that. And from there, you can make rules around your money. And I think for many people, there is no peace around money because They haven't established a philosophy. They haven't established a vision. They don't have rules around their money. And so there's a lot of chaos and a lot of noise. And so if you get nothing else from this video today, at least walk away thinking, all right, what is it that I want for my money? What is the vision for my money? And the whole 100-year mindset and that whole 100-year brand came from wanting our clients to look at their lives and look at the decisions that they're making around their money from a 100-year perspective. And if you bring that back home to today, I know people make very different decisions when they're looking out into the horizon from a vision perspective of what they want for their money.
That's great. Thank you so much for that, Teresa. And thank you all out there for listening today. If you want more information, if you'd like to schedule a call with one of our team members, if you have some questions or some other myths that you'd like busted by one of our team members that we didn't cover today, you can go to www.100100yearrei.com, and you can schedule a call with our team. Thanks so much.
Thank you.